Hello and welcome to the show. I'm your host, Jason Knight, and on each episode of this podcast, I'll be having conversations with the brightest and best minds I can find to help inspire all of us to make amazing products, amazing product teams, and amazing product companies. If you like the sound of that, why not head over to onenightinproduct.com, where you can sign up to the newsletter, check out some of my other episodes with thought leaders and practitioners, and find a podcast on your favourite podcast app so you can make sure to never miss another episode again. Oh, and do make sure to tell your friends while you're at it. On tonight's episode, we speak all about being fearless in your quest for good product decision-making. We ask, how can we be customer-focused if we don't even know who our customers are or what characteristics they share? How can we stand up for evidence in the face of unshakable confidence? And how can we double down on continuous discovery to remove blind spots about our users without getting poked in the eye by angry user researchers while we're at it? For all this and much more, please join us on One Night in Product. So my guest tonight is Hope Gourion. Hope's a product leader and product coach who wants us all to be bolder, but use evidence when making decisions. Now, I don't know what you're talking about, Hope. Surely whatever the CEO has told me is evidence enough. Hope used to work at a dry cleaners, but these days she's fearlessly helping product teams get the stains out of their product strategy and help deliver a nicely pressed and folded product vision. Hope's also made it into Marty Kagan's Magnificent Seven. Seven coaches he called out as top recommendations in his new book Transformed, which is high praise indeed, although so far I do have to say there's not a single poncho in sight. Hi Hope, how are you tonight?
I'm great. Thanks so much, Jason. I can't believe you know that I worked at a dry cleaner's. That was one of my first jobs. It was a good job.
Well, I would like to take credit for that, but I'll point out that you filled in a questionnaire about that a few months back now.
Oh, I forgot. Okay, yes.
All right. So first things first, you are the founder of Fearless Product LLC. So what problems are you and your company solving for the world?
Well, when I started, which was sort of by accident, I pretty quickly recognized, and this was, I think, before, this is probably like 2017, 2018, there weren't a lot of product coaches, but the few that I knew, it was hard for me to differentiate, see like what they were specializing in, if you will. And so for me, what I wanted to focus on were people who were put, you know, took on the VP of product, head of product role, whatever it was at their company from a non-product background, which was pretty common. There are not a lot of experienced product leaders. Companies that need an experienced product leader, sometimes the experienced product leaders don't want to go to that company because they know that those companies probably don't have all the things that are required, like Marty describes in Transformed. And so it's challenging, but yet they know that their product is key to their company's success. So that's who I wanted to focus on, was helping those first-time product leaders really figure out what they need to do in their job and how can they learn that making less mistakes than they would if they did it through trial and error. So that was my focus.
So are you saying then, you know, hot take alert, but are you saying then that you don't work with experienced product leaders, but you're more of a transformer of product leaders yourself?
Yeah, when I'm coaching product leaders, most of the time, I have worked with some very experienced product leaders, people who've written books on product management, but I would say that's not the norm. The norm is more that these are first-time product leaders, usually from adjacent functions, could be engineering, could be design, could be marketing. Like, I mean, I've really worked with people from all kinds of different backgrounds who ended up being in charge of product. And so really trying to help them have credibility with their teams, have credibility to be able to hire experienced product leaders or product people for their teams, helping them figure out how to structure their teams, how to come up with strategy, how to align their executive teams on the very hard trade-offs that they inevitably have to navigate. So that's typically who I focus on when I'm coaching product leaders.
So without getting anyone in trouble, like, what is the function that you find in that type of equation that maybe has the most trouble transferring to a quote unquote proper product mindset? Like, you talked about engineers, you talked about marketing, you talked about, you know, I can potentially think, for example, subject matter experts or industry experts and stuff like that.
Yep.
Is there a particular type of function that maybe has the biggest gap to cross, or do you find it's a bit of a mixed bag?
I don't find it function specific. I find it person with mindset specific. Like, I think that is the most common denominator, right? Like, and I would say those people wouldn't choose to work with me. Like, if you think you know what you're doing, whether you've done it before or not, you aren't likely to seek a coach. And therefore, you're unlikely to end up on my doorstep at any point in time. But people who recognize that there's probably some gaps in their experience and knowledge, and they feel a lot of pressure to make sure that they really are helping their companies succeed. They want to be successful in their role. They want to maybe make more right decisions than wrong decisions, you know, expedite. Usually when people are put into this role, it's because the role has been absent for a while, which means there's a lot of, you know, less than ideal decisions that have been made. And so there's pent up frustrations in the organization. It's just like, it's a lot for a head of product to walk into that situation. And so I try to be there. I call my coaching services phone a friend, because I want people to feel like somebody really cares about their success. And it can be very lonely in organizations where you're the first time product leader at a company that has never had that function, doesn't know what it should do. Everybody thinks they know how to do it better than that person. Like, it's rough.
Oh, yeah. I remember seeing some article once, and I can't remember who wrote it, so I'll have to try and dig it out. But it was basically along the lines of, you never want to be the first product person, or you never want to be what they call like the first product person. You always want to be the second first product person, because you know, the first one's the one that got
the sacrificial lamb.
The sacrificial lamb. They've had all of the arrows fired at them, and they've maybe kind of helped change a little bit of understanding, at least, of what product managers or product leaders are like. But they were never going to succeed because the gap was too far.
Yeah.
So you're talking a lot about these people coming in from kind of around and about, like, and basically skilling them up and teaching them the things and covering the gaps or filling the gaps that they have.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that the product leaders themselves are bringing you in, or do you tend to find that the founders or the leaders are the ones that say, hey, we've just hired Chip, and we've noticed that he hasn't got such and such a set of skills? Like, how does that tend to happen?
Yeah, it has happened that way, but that's not my preferred way of, you know, sometimes it's been like, you know, somebody like an operating partner from a VC firm, or sometimes it's been the CEO. But more often than not, and usually what I prefer, is that the person themselves, right? Because, you know, it's like when you're managing a team, right? Like, who are you going to invest in giving feedback to? The people who are like, I want to get better in this role and succeed, or the people who feel like they've got it all figured out and don't want to seek help? Like, again, people self-select, and that means that we usually have very good working relationships.
But you talk about it being a lonely job, and of course, I completely agree with that, and especially when you're the first person in the team, in the company, the first person that's maybe been advocating for some of this stuff. And I personally talk a lot about this idea that companies kind of just get to a point, almost not necessarily by accident as such, but like there's a bunch of decisions that are made that maybe the leadership of those companies thinks is going to continue to work forever, and then they stop working and they start to realize maybe they need to try something different, but they don't know what, and they don't trust this new product thing. And like you say, it could be lonely. And this new person isn't necessarily set up for success. Obviously, you're going to try and help them be successful. But you know, going back to the Magnificent Seven analogy, did you ever kind of go in all guns blazing trying to help them deal with the CEO directly, or try and affect the change yourself? Or are you always trying to operate directly through your coachee?
Yeah, most of the time when I'm coaching somebody, like they really, like I'm like the person in the background really trying to help them look at options, like really diagnose what is their challenge. Sometimes they come into a coaching session with a like, okay, you know, my team is telling me we have no vision. And so I feel like I want to solve that. And then we'll dive into like, well, what really is that going to do for you and your team? What, how you're going to use it? So like usually people come into a coaching session with like one or two or three challenges that we're trying to help them make progress on. Sometimes that means that like, sometimes it's a decision they make on their own. That's less often the case. Usually it's something they need to do with their peers and partners, again, marketing, sales, you know, other members of the executive team, engineering, whoever. So most of the time I'm helping them figure out how they're going to move the ball forward on that challenge. And it's usually in collaboration with others. And they are the hero of their journey. So I, you know, if people want to bring me in to do workshops and other things, like, yes, we'll do that sometimes. But more often than not, like, I want the leader to take ownership over the actions that they're going to take, put them into practice, reflect on what's working, what isn't, refine, keep moving.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've had a few discussions around coaching principles. And I know, for example, that our mutual friend Marty is very keen to say that you have to be very much an experienced product leader to be able to go in and do some of these things. But then I've spoken to other coaching thought leaders that are like, well, a good coach can coach anyone, you know, almost like Ted Lasso, right? They can just go in and use their fundamental coaching skills to just make people better and self-actualize and do some of the things you say, like own their own future.
Mm-hmm.
So how far do you like to get as a coach into this kind of, well, this is the sort of thing you should do, you know, Chip, or versus trying to get them to come up with a solution on their own?
Yeah. So I think you're right. If I had no experience in this realm, I would probably be doing a lot of questioning to see if they could come up with their own options. But I do have experience in this realm. So that's usually the case where if somebody says, I want them to have, sometimes they're like, look, I literally have no idea how to do this. I've never done it before. I feel very nervous about it. And we get to like, okay, what's the first step that we could take? So a vision is a great example of that, right? Like not that many product leaders, especially if you're a first-time product leader, have done product vision. Okay. So like, I wouldn't expect them to have experience or even know what the first step would look like. But then we can start to do that together. If they have like, here's what I'm thinking I'm doing, which most of the clients that I work with, they, you know, they're smart people. They try to solve problems. They figure something out. They're like, here's what I think I'm going to do. Can you react to that? And what I try to do is say like either, yes, that's perfect, or have you thought about it this way or this way? And here's the situations where these might be more effective. And then they can decide. And that way they've got, you know, they can make a compare and contrast decision. They can look at the pros and cons of different options, think about what feels right for their situation for themselves, and then move it forward. So that's where I feel like if you're not an experienced product leader, I think it would be difficult for you to be able to provide alternate options to your clients.
No, absolutely. And one thing that I've reflected on through some of my own coaching as well is like the importance of almost treating it like a continuum, because some people will sit there and say like, mentorship's over here, that's the prescriptive stuff, and then coaching's over here, and that's the non-prescriptive stuff, and never the twain shall meet. But you know, for me, it's almost like, yeah, where do you fall on the spectrum? Like, where do you need to focus your laser pointer at any particular time? Really depends on the needs. And as long as you're basically giving them ultimate control and empowering them, I think that's where it seems to make sense. So yeah, I think I kind of get both sides of the argument, but I think that ultimately I've not seen many product people out there that are like, just ask me questions. Like they all seem to want at least some level of guidance, because it's a tricky job and it's lonely, like you say, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And I think one of the groups that I'm involved with that I think helps a lot of product leaders in this case is a group called Collaborative Gain. And Phil Terry was one of the other people in the Transform book. And so he runs this, and it's councils of non-competitive peer groups. And I see the products. So I moderate the product leader council. Like the product leaders on that council, like they have a challenge, they bring it to their peers to see how have you tackled it. And they get, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 different perspectives on how people have solved that challenge in the past. And like, it's so much more empowering to help see, oh gosh, you gave me a perspective I didn't have. You gave me an idea I didn't have. Now I've got, you know, conviction and evidence behind that conviction, and I can, you know, move it forward. So I just find that very powerful.
No, absolutely. That kind of co-opetition that you get in certain consulting game, right? But on your LinkedIn, you say that you advise product leaders and product teams on product leadership and discovery best practices to fuel professional and business growth through customer-centric, evidence-based strategies.
Yeah, I think I should edit that, huh? It's kind of it's kind of wordy.
ChatGPT's got your back.
I should check that out.
Now, I understand what all that means, and I'd definitely buy that for a dollar. But for the record, how are you specifically defining customer-centric?
Yeah. So I'll tell you that more often than not, when I'm working with a product leader, when I'm working with product teams, the who is your customer? Because we start, that's one of the very first questions we have to discuss, is often not clear. And so it's really hard to do discovery, to make decisions, to evaluate evidence if you're not totally sure who your customer is. And, you know, in certain contexts, you know, marketplaces, often in B2B, there can be many influencers, the buyer decision maker, the budget holder versus the end user, power users, admin users. Like, there's a lot of different customer segments. And so, like, to me, being customer centric is picking a point of focus for a period of time, or when you're doing, if it's for a longer period of time, if it's part of your strategy, part of your competitive differentiation, part of your value proposition, like, it is critically important to define who your target customer is and what are the attributes of that, whether it's role, whether it's industry, whether it's, you know, demographic attributes that help you know who you most need to learn from to calibrate your decisions as a product team.
But one thing I see, and I'm a very much a B2B kind of guy, so maybe I see it a bit more than some of the cool B2C people that, you know, kick sand in our faces when we go to the beach. But one thing that I see a lot is that companies, and we're talking about like the types of companies that maybe this is the first time they've had a product leader, maybe the first time they've tried to think about things in a product sense, and they kind of have too many different types of customer. Like, they never really did the work to segment or mark out the types of customer they should be going after. They get a very distributed set of customer profiles, which mean that it's almost impossible to work out who your best customer is, because they're all kind of almost as good as each other, but they have very different sets of requirements and motivations and drivers and all of that stuff.
Yep.
So is there any approach that you go in with and say, okay, right, this is the thing that we need to do. We need to kind of narrow down, niche down. And how does that go? Because quite often people are quite averse to niching down.
Well, right, because we want to serve everybody, because we don't want to limit any opportunity. But obviously, like, that means no focus. No focus means no progress. So usually what I do is a very simple exercise. Again, this is not hard. It's just not common. Who is our customer? If it's members of the product team, members of the executive team, put the stickies on the board, doing your best to describe who the customer is. And often we see it described very differently by different people, right? Often, many times I see teams, especially in companies that are not yet working in a product operating model, where they're using proxies. You know, the customer support team or customer facing teams are our customers because they know the actual customers so well. Or, you know, usually if you're working with a product marketing person, like, they're really good at being able to define this. But for me, one of the things that I think is critical is identifiable attributes of those customers. Meaning, if we wrote down these attributes, we could find a way to contact those people. Like, we could, if it was B2B, like, we could look up that title on LinkedIn and see people who are like that. Or, you know, other ways that you could find them to be. That way we can size them, we can contact them to do discovery, we can gauge, is this our customer, and compare it to maybe another customer segment that we might be interested in. So even if you want to be everything to everybody, you have to start by being something to somebody. And that's where I want people to start.
No, absolutely. Well, I'm obviously all for that. But I think it's fair to say we've nailed customers, so to speak. But let's go to the second part of your very long sentence, the last little bit. How are you defining evidence? And again, I want you to be very specific.
Yeah. So evidence is, I would say, the thing that for me and most of the people that I work with fuels our confidence. Like, one of the things that I've always had an aversion to are people who are confident just because it's a personality trait of theirs. Like, I just don't respond well to it. I know something must have happened to me in childhood. You know, it falls apart really quickly once you start asking a few questions, right? Like, what informed that perspective? You know, how many customers have you talked to? Could you introduce me to some of them? And when people start to get defensive about that, it becomes very obvious that this is actually their point of view, their worldview, and not something that is grounded in a lot of experience that we could recreate. So when I think about evidence, it's something that we could measure, observe, see, right? It's not just a story that we tell ourselves. So there's so many different categories of evidence, right? There's observations of our customers. There's observations of our customers interacting with our products or competitors' products. There's analytics, but analytics are only as good as the degree to which they were implemented with integrity and are actually measuring what you think. So you could have analytics and not have evidence. And so, like, we really have to look at what is it that we're trying to understand and what are qualitative, quantitative options that can help us understand or get an answer to a question that we're trying to learn about that'll inform the next decision we have to make.
It's funny because when you talk about people's confidence, it reminds me of the confidence meter that Itamar Gilad made. I don't know if you've seen that, this kind of circle of like from anecdotal all the way up to we've actually seen it work in the field sort of thing. One thing I like about it is it's a logarithmic scale. So like the quality of the evidence dramatically increases the further up you go.
Yeah.
But another thing that I think about with regards to that type of visualization is it's not just features that need to be confidence prioritized. It's also people. And you kind of touched on that yourself, right? Like some people are just super confident and everything's a 10.
Yeah.
And some people are like, you know, proper doubting Thomases or moaning minis or whatever. And they're always down the bottom. So what do you do to try and calibrate for the intrinsic confidence of these people? And also crucially to make sure that that's not then seen as an attack on that person's ideas.
Yeah. So this is why I think the cross-functional team nature of product is so powerful, because so many organizations that, again, aren't quite yet working this way, the confidence historically has been in somebody, leader, stakeholder, the person who put together the business case, the person who went to finance, the person who was persuasive enough to get a team put on something or hired an outside firm or an agency to do something and was very just directive about whatever it was that they wanted to pursue. But to your point, the other end of the spectrum is some teams, maybe they're PTSD from that way of working. And so they want to be so research heavy to make their decisions, to counteract maybe this former way or things that they've seen, you know, take them down the wrong path, that they end up wanting to do like extensive research for the most minor decisions. That's not good either, right? Like we need to have this, like, and this is where I think a team can help. What is the decision we're trying to make? What is the risk of us being wrong in that decision? And like, I think the framing, I think it's Jeff Bezos originally wrote the sort of one-way, two-way door decisions, I find as a big unlock for teams. Because if they can just like, wait a minute, is this a decision that if we make it like really difficult to unwind, okay, on that logarithmic scale of evidence, we're probably going to want to be further up, right? But if this is a decision that turns out we're wrong, we chose a, you know, maybe a not so impactful opportunity to solve, maybe, you know, the way that we're solving it is like not that great, well, we can iterate on it or we can change it. You know, we can roll it back with our feature flag, whatever it is. And that just sort of takes the pressure off and helps right size the amount of evidence we need to make a good enough decision and then adjust if it turns out not to have the result that we expect.
No, absolutely. It just reminds me of thinking in bets, the Annie Duke thing, you know, like everything's a bet, right? And, you know, sometimes I don't know if you play poker or if you've ever played poker, but just this idea that sometimes it's okay to, you know, just pop something in the pot just to see what happens
Yes. Well, yes.
I actually really love poker as an example for this because, and again, this won't mean anything to anyone who hasn't played it, but like the idea that by making a small bet, you learn more about everyone else in the hand. And then that means that you can then decide whether to make a bigger bet or whether to fold. And of course, also this idea that sometimes you just got to throw it away.
Yeah.
Sometimes the bet didn't pay off and you luckily made a small enough bet that it wasn't really a tournament ending thing, but your hand that you thought was good, actually you got to get rid of it and live to fight another day. So I think there are just so many lessons to be learned from poker. I just wish I was any good at it.
Well, this is also where like the beauty in that poker analogy is that like you can learn in short cycles, right? Like, but a lot of teams that I find have like are, you know, sort of swinging the pendulum to like, you know, perfect research are because they don't get another chance to play another hand, right? Like there's such long investment periods. We never come back to it because it's that project way of investing, not a durable product team. And so it does feel like a one-way door decision. And so that causes that evidence to go up. And the shame of it is that their organizations, if they're frustrated with the length of time things take or the amount of expense it takes and the low impact, which probably causes them to want to transform the way they're working, it starts with those behaviors in the system, right? How do we fund projects instead of funding teams? How do we justify resource allocation? Like a lot of that comes down to the ways of working that have been established at the leadership team level that need to be unwound. And you know, they have to look at themselves, not just at the ways of working in their teams. And so this is why I think it is challenging for a lot of companies and leaders to transform the way that they're working.
Well, that's an interesting point, though, because that transformation, and of course, transformation these days, very popular topical concept because of Mr. Kagan's book, but also talking about like this idea of one-way, two-way doors, right? And you only get one shot. And I think that one thing that I've seen, and I think I spoke to Martin about this, but I'm curious about what your take is as well, is this idea that a leader will start wanting to do these things because maybe they've started to realize that the wheels aren't going as fast as they used to be, or that things are starting to slip through the cracks. They know that they need something and they think this is the thing that they need. They start investing. Maybe they pay out for you to come in or whatever it is that they do to start going down that path. But the first hurdle, they realize that it's hard. Maybe they have to make some counterintuitive decisions and they get scared, to your point about being fearless, and then they back off and they don't do it again.
Yep.
How do we stop people basically bottling out?
So for me, this always comes back to really trying to understand the motivation for changing the ways of working in the first place. And I find that like if you don't have sufficient, recent, palpable pain in the ways of current that you're currently operating or the problems those have caused, and again, this is where it's like maybe less true nowadays, our employees are leaving us, our competitors are gaining ground on us, or new competitors are gaining ground on us, our investors are losing confidence in us. Like you need to have something that feels really painful that you don't want to fall back to, that is going to help propel you forward into new ways of working. If it's just wouldn't it be cool if we worked this way? Like really easy to be like, that was a nice idea. Let's just go back to like the business case and year-long projects. And then, you know, everybody's going to move on to the next thing. And did it work out? I don't know. Nobody ever checked because we're so excited about the next thing we're going to fund.
So one thing we spoke about before this, I think you put it in the questionnaire, is that sometimes there are warning signs that you can pick up when you go into an organization, or maybe after you've been working in or around that organization for a little bit, that basically none of this stuff's actually going to work out there, that there's just some kind of intrinsic barrier or lack of buy-in or all the other things that could get in the way. So what are some of the biggest kind of red flags or warning signs that you've seen in the companies or the leaders that you've been working that start to make you feel that maybe this isn't the place where the product operating model is going to work or some of this evidence-based decision-making is going to happen?
Yeah. Well, so usually what will be a reason that we like would tell a prospective client, like maybe now is not the right time for you to make this type of investment, is when it's sort of like training for training's sake. Like we have this budget, we haven't done training in a while. Hey, we think it would be really cool if people are really interested in these concepts. And I'm like, sure, we can do a training. We can teach you about product discovery. This is more when we're looking at trainings, not like a product leader, because that doesn't usually happen with a product leader. Like I can spot the signs and then at some point we can decide if that product leader wants to stay in this role or not. But it's more related to like, should we invest in doing a big training for multiple product teams? If it's not being sponsored by the leader, if there isn't like a known catalyst, and I'll ask for that, like, oh, why are you interested in this training? Well, we've been reading the book, but we're struggling to put it into practice. Okay. If it's, we haven't done a training in a while and people think it's really cool, I'm like, we could, but I just don't think you're going to get value out of it, right? Because it's just then, okay, we learned another way of working and we're just going to toss it to the side and go back to the ways that we've always done things. It's just not a good use of anybody's time. And in the worst case scenario, the people who recognize, wow, this is what we should be doing, And there is really no appetite for that here. People are so caught up in their own conviction around the ideas that got funded, you know, last January, and we can't pivot off of it because that was the idea that got funded, even though like nobody wants it, nobody's going to use it, it's not likely to succeed. Then those people are like, wait a minute, do I want to work this way? Maybe I want to find a company that will support these ways of working. So it can have an unintended consequence. So I really want leaders and teams to recognize whether it's the right time for that. Now, if you're a leader and you're like, I know that we can't go back to the ways that we've previously made decisions where somebody had a great idea, we pushed it through production, lo and behold, nobody used it, it didn't create any value, and we can't do that anymore, then I'm like, okay, I've got something to work with here. But there needs to be that palpable, like, what are we running away from? Because that is going to sustain you through all the change management, hearts, minds, practices required to operate differently.
So what are some really common kind of almost change events that you see that maybe precipitate some of this stuff in the first place? So like when you go in and maybe they do have some of the conditions, or at least the appetite, or the CEO buy-in, or whatever it is that you need to be successful. But the thing that actually, like the straw that broke the camel's back, like, are there kind of common patterns that you see that this is the time when they start to think that that's the thing that they should do?
Yeah. So touched on a couple of them. One is, you know, like we're losing ground to competitors. Like maybe we once had a competitive advantage and we're losing it. And how did they identify that need that we missed? How did they, you know, attack it with their products so quickly? Like, why are we losing customers to them? That's usually a pretty big motivator that gets the attention of the leadership team more than just like the product leader. In a time when I know it's a little bit different in tech right now because there've been, you know, we sort of maybe overhired and have had to cut back. But a time when people are like, we're losing our best people, that would also sort of trigger, you know, engineers have been difficult to hire, product people have been difficult to hire, designers have been difficult to hire. And so when people, a leader sees that like the best people are like walking out because they're like, this doesn't make sense, I don't believe in this company's future, that can be a trigger when we do some exit interviews to understand why. Investor confidence, again, if it's a privately funded and we're like the investor team is looking at all those quarterly reports and not really seeing anything that gives them confidence that this company is headed on the right path, that there's a lot of demand for that product that they just need to execute and fulfill against, that's usually a catalyst. So those are some of the big ones that usually create enough of a discomfort in the status quo that we're going to be open to different ways of working and making decisions.
Well, fingers crossed. But we've touched on a few things in this interview around evidence, around training, around layoffs. And one thing that's been kind of out and about around the social media over the last few weeks or months or whenever it was now, everything kind of just blurs into one, is this kind of concept that some of the stuff that I know that you're involved, for example, with Teresa Torres on workshops and training around discovery and kind of some of the stuff that you've been talking about today. And there's this kind of narrative going around at the moment that we dastardly product managers are going out there and doing all of this stuff, you know, the continuous discovery, the evidence gathering, the research, the things that, you know, a lot of product managers want to do more of if they get the chance to do it at all. But that, you know, to some extent that we should be backing off and letting the sainted user research teams go out and do that stuff. You know, these professionals that are the ones that really know how to do it and that we're just going in and breaking it all.
Yeah.
And also worse still that we're somehow killing the trade of user research, and in fact, almost contributing to the layoffs of user researchers. Like, do you see any of that out and about in your travels?
I mean, I definitely encounter that. Here's my take on it. Most companies don't have as many user researchers as they have products and product teams. It's very rare that I have ever, in fact, I'm not sure I've ever seen that. So then it begs the question of how do we help teams make customer-centric, evidence-based decisions to achieve the desired results for their products and for their companies and their customers? So there, you could solve that how in many ways. You could hire a lot more user researchers and have that be something the team sort of outsources to an expert, to a specialist. But the risk in that is that the teams don't end up with the firsthand knowledge about what the customer is trying to do, what their alternatives are, what their, you know, pain points are, what their potential delighters are. And so then it ends up being a crutch or often a bottleneck for those teams. And so like then the team has to decide, are we just going to slow down our decision making to match the pace of the expert? Or are we going to see if there's other ways that we can get the knowledge that we desperately need to expedite our decisions to achieve our outcomes? And that's where I see most teams going. So when a company is fortunate enough to have user research, they are typically in the role of guiding the teams or doing more longitudinal or cross-team research to supplement or complement what the teams are doing. So do I think that that has led to less user researchers? Not really, because most companies didn't have like teams of user researchers. I think each person who's feeling pain around that also has to question, like, what am I worried about? Like when I hear a user researcher say, but what if they don't do it right? This is often a question that comes up when we're teaching teams how to practice continuous discovery. They're like, I'm worried they won't do it right. They'll ask leading questions in an interview, or, you know, they'll draw the wrong conclusions. And I ask, like, well, what is the risk of that? Does that mean that they choose to solve a problem that isn't big enough, like that will have not much impact on their outcome? Maybe they might choose a low point of leverage, a low impact opportunity to solve. If they do that, then yes, it might delay their progress to an outcome. They might, with your help, maybe they would have chosen a bigger opportunity to solve. But that's a two-way door decision, right? Like we're never just solving one opportunity. We've got to solve many opportunities over time. And if teams solve an opportunity and then see that it has very little impact on their outcome, they will also learn from that experience. And they will see firsthand, which is usually the experience that is more likely to stick with the person. They'll remember it, they'll retain it, and they want to avoid that pain in the future. They'll say, how did we miss that? And how could we get data and evidence to choose a bigger impact opportunity that's reflective of more of our customers, would have more impact on our outcome? So like, I'm not worried about the team's ability to figure that out with or without the help of an experienced user researcher. I think that the two can be very complementary. I just think people have to be specific about the risks that they're worried about if there's not a user researcher doing all the user research.
So one devil's advocate position I could take against that, and one that I've heard, one position that there is out there is that what we're doing in those situations is we're prioritizing speed and effectively experimenting on our users and making their experience worse potentially because we're not doing the right things. What do you think about that position?
Yeah, so most teams, in fact, all teams have imperfect understanding of their product, the pain points associated with their product, with their customers, their prospects, their target customers. And we try to use continuous discovery to remove as many of those blind spots as possible. But we don't wait until we have perfect understanding of the opportunity space to try to make progress on our outcome, which is why I say the risk is we choose a low impact opportunity, but all of the opportunities are grounded in evidence. They come from customer interviews, observations. So again, the risk is that we choose a low impact opportunity, which isn't a need reflective of, say, the majority of our customers or users. But does that mean that it introduces pain for other customers? That might be a risk, right? That might be something that we want to guard against in an assumption test, right? Like if we solve this pain, does it drive our outcome in a way that maintains sentiment and, you know, usage of our product, or does it erode it in some way? And again, if you've got a measure of success for your product in the form of an outcome, you see that pretty quickly. And let's say you do make it worse. Well, you're probably going to want to fix that because your measure of success is to drive the outcome. So this is again where, like, maybe at a point in time, yes, a team could solve a low impact opportunity and it might have, you know, unintended negative consequences for customers. But I don't see that as a higher risk than the delay that might be caused waiting for a user researcher to be available to do that research, and the risk of the team not having firsthand understanding of their customers' context, and understanding of their product in that customer's life. So there's just different risks that we have to mitigate as a team.
All goes back down to the right size of the bet, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's also fair to say, and I've been thinking about this a little bit recently, it's just kind of feels like user researchers and product managers are shouting at each other about something, you know, for example, product outcomes not being the best or user experience not being the best, and they're all blaming each other for that or complaining at each other about that, but it's not really either of their team's fault, really.
Right.
And probably up to and including the layoffs that people may or may not be experiencing due to things like continuous discovery habits. Is like, there's a whole system that we all sit in that's kind of this uncaring corporate system that we all live in that's making all of the bad decisions that you've talked about not wanting these companies to do. And it just feels like we're all kind of victims of that same system and to be working together to try and fix it, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. That's where, like, I don't see it as an either or. I see it as an and. And what tool are we going to use for which types of problems? And recognizing that there's going to be trade-offs. Like, there's going to be things that aren't exactly ideal. But it was never ideal in the first place. So who cares? We're trying to make it better.
Step by step.
Yes.
Marginal gains.
Yes.
Well, sounds good. And hopefully we can inspire people to try and team up and band together and try and help solve some of those problems together for a change rather than doing what people normally do and just kind of retrenching into their positions.
Yes.
But where can people find you after this if they want to find out about losing their fear, getting stuck in with evidence-based decision-making, sorting out their vision or strategy, or maybe even getting some dry cleaning tips?
Obviously, I'm on LinkedIn. That's probably the place you can find me, or you can go to my website, fearless-product.com.
Well, there you go. I'll make sure to link that one into the show notes and hopefully get a few people heading into your general direction. Well, that's been a fantastic chat. So obviously glad you could spare some time to speak about some deep and meaningful topics. Obviously, we'll stay in touch. But yeah, as for now, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Jason. It was a lot of fun.
As always, thanks for listening. I hope you found the episode inspiring and insightful. If you did, again, I can only encourage you to pop over to onenightinproduct.com, check out some of my other fantastic guests, sign up to the mailing list or subscribe on your favorite podcast app, and make sure you share with your friends so you and they can never miss another episode again. I'll be back soon with another inspiring guest, but as for now, thanks and good night.